We have a friend named Dan Rossi that's been on the show two or three times before. That just has been on, and we all know about this on the list, so we've been just very curious and talked about him. When will he be back? Will he make it and all this? Dan Rossi from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Bill. How about yourself?
Well, good. You say it's not a very pleasant morning up there on Wednesday, the whatever this is, the 19th?
Yeah. 19th, I think. Yeah, no, it's snowing and cold and and just a miserable day out there.
But you walk to work anyway.
I walk to work anyway.
Yeah. Well, I guess there would be no subway, so you'd walk to work or you wouldn't go.
Yeah, exactly. In this area, just because of living near the university, there's no buses that kind of run the north-south run, and because I'm pretty close, I'm only a mile away, so it's just tough. Walking in is the easiest way.
Yeah, and after we tell this story, people will go, well, walking to work's a piece of cake for a guy like you. All right, we'll just let you ramble. I'm going to turn my mic off and listen.
Okay. About, I don't know, it was not quite a year ago, I got an email from a friend who I was with when I went to Nepal a few years back, and she said, she was organizing a climb of Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa and asked me if I'd be interested in going. So I of course, said, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And spent a lot of time planning and, preparing, hitting the gym really hard, climbing stairs, just getting ready. And so on December 27th, I jumped on a plane and took off and found myself in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
30 hours later, and went and climbed Kilimanjaro. It was a terrific climb. There were 8 of us climbing, and overall it was very successful. We got 8 out of 8 people to the crater rim at Gilman's Point, and 6 out of 8 of us made it to the summit at Uhuru.
Now, you say the crater's rim, but it's at like 18,000 feet or something.
Yeah, the crater rim, Gilman's Point, is about 18,500 feet. Kilimanjaro is a giant dormant volcano, and it's a very impressive-looking mountain. It has the claim of being the tallest freestanding mountain in the world because it's just one huge volcano, one huge mountain in the middle of a plain. So where a mountain like Everest, which is the tallest mountain in the world, is kind of like a 12,000-foot mountain on a major ridgeline, on a 17,000-foot ridgeline.
Yeah, because there are other mountains around it.
Right, exactly. There's all kinds of mountains all around it. Where Kilimanjaro is just a mountain sticking right up, out of the middle of the plain. So from base to the summit, it looks huge, and it is huge. It takes up, when you're kind of at the base of it, but if you look from edge to edge of the base, it takes up a good part of the horizon view, because it's just a giant mountain.
Yeah,
and it's got a huge crater up at the top, and it's a very symmetrical big hole in the top of the mountain, and the very top of the mountain is covered mostly by a glacier. Glacier is about 70 feet thick, so it's nothing like, one of the Arctic glaciers, but it's about, it's a good 70 feet thick and covers a good part of the mountain, although we didn't actually have to cross the glacier on the climb. And it's a very interesting mountain because it covers from the base to the top. As you climb up toward the summit, you cross through all of these very distinct habitats, very distinct climate zones.
So sure.
At the very base of the mountain, you're in basically jungle or rainforest. and it's, you know, heavily wooded, you know, a thick canopy overhead. We saw a number of monkeys and evidence of elephant, and you know, it's just that, you know, like from the old movies, you know, very dank, forested, you know, vines hanging down from trees and moss all over the trees. Really, really kind of funky experience to be walking through all that, and very wet, you know, some streams and just very rainy kind of area. And then as you climb up, that was the first day, and then the next 2 days you're walking up through what they call moorlands. So it's some trees, but they're shorter, they're more scattered. There's giant heather plants all over the place, kind of boggy area, and, you know, more low scrub kind of stuff, especially on the third day, just kind of scrub trees and such. Some people kept commenting that it looked like very Dr. Seuss-like because of the giant plants and everything. After that, on the fourth day, we actually crossed a high-altitude desert. And when I mean desert, this was desert. It was desolate.
A high-altitude desert with sand?
Yes, it was sand, gravel. Occasionally, you'd see a boulder, but they're really, you know, spread out. You know, you might see them off in the distance. Very smooth. You know, it's as a matter of fact, the trekking was so smooth at that point. Normally, I have two trekking poles, and I use them, you know, reaching out in front of me.
Feel step.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they come in very handy if you trip or stumble, because you're basically on four legs. So it helps with the balance a lot. And then somebody in front of me rings a bell. I carry, they're called bear bells, but they're just little kind of jingle bells. And I just follow along listening for the bell, and people call out certain things, you know, certain, if there's a large rock in the trail or, crossing the high altitude desert, it was so smooth and such a low grade of, you know, inclination that, I was not even using the trekking poles. I just was carrying them in my hand, and for a while I carried the bell myself because there was just nothing to stumble over. I could just listen to the person's footsteps in front of me and easily follow, and it was just this wind-blown, flat desert. It was amazing.
I would love that.
It was great. It was great trekking. I had no problem.
So you were just walking along, listening for the guy in front of you's crunching.
Yep.
And just walking along, swinging your arms, and
that'd
be damn. What a deal.
That was. It was. It was great. It was great trekking. And that was from about 14,000 feet to 15,500 feet.
Which took how long, a day?
That took the better part of a day because it's kind of a shallow grade, so it was, you know, it was just a long day of walking. Maybe about 6.5 hours that day of walking, and that put us up to School Hut, which is the last place we stay before pushing for the summit. Let me step back. The night before School Hut, the day before we started crossing this plain, we stayed at a place called Moenzi Tarn, which is, I thought, was a very interesting place. It's a big hole in the side of the mountain, and there's a small pond at the bottom of it, and we kind of stayed down in this hole. And there were actually three groups of climbers, and it was just a really neat place to be. You know, it's just this giant, kind of a crater in the side of the mountain, and there's a little pond down there, and we set up our tents on the shore of this little pond, and I had this picture in my head that it must have been pretty cool.
Let me ask you this: could you hear? Is the crater small enough that you Because, you know, if you're blind and you're outside and there's nothing around you and you have nothing to bounce an echo off of,
right,
you tend to become a little bit disoriented.
Right.
You don't know up from down or right from left. So could you hear the walls of the crater when you were down in there?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was big, but it was, you know, you could definitely tell the boundaries.
That you were in something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and when we were out on the desert, like you were saying, yeah, it's just so big and so open that there's nothing, there's no echoes off of anything, and it is somewhat disorienting.
It would be if there weren't other persons around to take you.
Without a doubt, without a doubt.
Okay, so you can't down in this. And was it? What was it temperature wise? What are we talking about?
So you know, obviously, as you move up the mountain, it gets cooler and cooler.
Sure.
The night we stayed in Moenzi, the nighttime temperature probably went down into the 20s.
Uh-huh.
But the daytime temperature, it's really strange. The daytime temperature is probably in the 50s, but you're pretty high up, and you're basically right on the equator. I mean, Kilimanjaro sits about 3 degrees south of the equator, and that equatorial sun, it's pretty harsh.
Sure,
it may be 50 degrees, but if you didn't cover up, you'd get scorched really badly.
Yeah, so you start coming out of those parkas and things.
Yeah, you really do. I mean, we were arguing about, you know, if you left, some people had thermometers, you know, watch thermometers and stuff, and if you put it in the shade, it might read in 50, you know, plus or minus a couple of degrees. If you put it out in the sun, it was reading up to like 90 degrees better. So it's kind of weird because you're kind of almost hot and cold at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So when we got to School Hut, we got there in the afternoon, and it's a big building that's been built. You know, it's got a few, you know, a bunch of bunks in it and tables. And there is supposedly some electricity by solar, but we couldn't get it working.
So, but it's built for mountain climbers to stay in.
Yes.
Okay.
It's built for us to just, you know, spend the night. And we actually don't even spend a whole night. We got there in the afternoon. We spent an hour or so sorting out our gear and getting our stuff ready for the final assault on the mountain, and we had a lunch, our dinner, around 5 p.m., and then we went to bed, tried to get some sleep, and some people dozed off. It's kind of hard to sleep. You know, there's a bunch of people in one room. It's chilly but not cold because at least you're sheltered from the wind and everything.
Yeah.
And we got up at around 11 p.m. and we had some tea and coffee, a little bit of breakfast. And then we got our gear on and we left the hut at around just after midnight, about 10 after midnight.
And they knew that the moon was going to be in a cycle where you'd have plenty of light or something?
Actually, I think the moon was nearly new, so there wasn't a whole lot of light from the moon, and everybody's wearing headlamps. The reason, apparently, that they like to do the climb at night is a good part of that last few thousand feet is the scree field. So it's loose gravel and sand, very, very, you know, kind of loose, sandy, gravelly soil, and at night it tends to freeze, so it stiffens up, and it's a little easier walking on than during the day. It's, you know, when it thaws, it's, you know, it'd be like trying to walk up a sand dune.
Uh-huh.
So that's why they tend to do it at night. And so we started climbing 10 after midnight and climbed up to a place called Hans Meyer Cave at, I forget what altitude that is. That's probably about 17,000 feet, maybe. And it's named after the first European who summited the mountain back in 1889, I think. And they call it a cave. And I even asked my guide, so, you know, have these caves been well explored? And he's like, well, they're only about 15 feet deep. So, yeah, they've been pretty well explored.
Pretty much.
So we stopped there, had some soup and some tea, and everybody was, you know, munching on snacks and sucking down. A lot of people had goo or gels, you know, these high-energy packets.
Yeah.
And drinking some water. And then we set out. We only stopped for maybe 15 minutes because it was pretty cold. At that time of night, you know, we were there around 3 a.m. It's in the teens, so it's kind of chilly. You don't want to stop for long.
You want to keep moving.
Keep moving. And from Hans Meyer Cave, we started up the main scree field, and you just kind of zigzag your way. It's a very steep slope, but you kind of just, you know, serpentine your way back and forth and very slow walking. I mean, it's almost maddeningly slow at times, but it is, you know, you are exerting yourself pretty good just to keep moving. And somewhere along the line, I found myself at in the front, because people stop, they take drinks, you know, and or you stop for a rest, and other people keep moving. Somewhere along the line, I ended up at the front, and
wow!
And it just so happened I was at the front when we got to the top. The last 100 feet or so before you get to the crater rim was pretty bouldery, because up until that point, the scree field was actually pretty easy walking. I mean, it's just, you know, because it's just this sand and gravel that's kind of frozen over.
Yeah.
It's relatively smooth.
Well, you were in the front. How did you know where to go?
Well, we had the head guide was ahead of me. So there's a head guide, and we had four mountain guides and eight climbers. And so the guides kind of, you know, stay in front of in front of the whole group and behind the whole group, and then, you know, they are kind of scattered between as we spread out. And so he was in front of me, and there was another guy who, another Western climber who was with me, who was kind of calling out any of the bigger rocks and such.
Uh-huh.
And so that last 100 feet or so were big boulders that got a little hairy, because you just had to kind of scramble over some of these bigger rocks. And around 5:30 a.m., we stepped up onto Gilman's Point, which is, you know, the one point of the rim of the crater. And there's a big sign there, you know, that says Gilman's Point, 18,500 feet. And we were all hugging each other and teary-eyed, and it was pretty exciting. We were all pretty happy that we had made it there.
Okay, but there's further to go.
There's further to go. So we waited 10 or 15 minutes for another couple to come up. So John Nichols and I had made the crater rim kind of together, and then we waited for another couple of climbers, Dana Welsh and John Smith. And they came up, and then the four of us decided to head out around the crater rim for Uhuru, which is the actual highest point on the mountain. And we started out, and I started feeling ill at that point. I had felt really strong right up to Gilman's Point, but as we started heading around the crater, I started feeling worse and worse. And we stopped at Stella Point for a few minutes to see the sunrise, and got some pictures of the sun rising. It was perfectly clear. It was relatively warm, because it can be brutally cold up there, but it was probably 20 degrees plus or minus a little bit, so comparatively it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
And it wasn't windy, and it was crystal clear. They said you could see forever. And by Stella Point, I was thinking, you know, I just want this to be over now.
Well, what do you think the deal was?
Well, it was altitude. You know, the altitude was finally getting to me. I had a bad headache. The nausea was starting, and I was just getting pretty fatigued. So we continued on, and we got to the altitude affects different people differently, and we actually saw one lady who was basically being dragged up the mountain at that point by, looked like maybe her boyfriend and a guide. And that's no way to do it. I mean, she was obviously in bad shape. And when we did finally get to the true summit at Uhuru, we were all very happy, but all of us were feeling pretty bad.
You say she's being dragged up the mountain because they couldn't leave her.
Well, no, and I guess, you know, they just, you know, a lot of people get summit fever, basically, and, you know, you're there, you've spent a lot of money to be there and get to the summit at any cost. And so they just kind of pulled her along, and she did, I guess, eventually get there and get her picture taken, and then they probably dragged her back down.
Yeah.
But she probably doesn't have fond memories of it.
I would think not.
Yeah.
So two of your party decided not to go any further.
Well, no, the four of us made it to Uhuru, and to be honest, you know, we all had these ideas of, you know, pictures we wanted, individual pictures taken by the sun and a group picture, and I had brought this silly little troll with me that you're supposed to take pictures of your troll, like, all over the world and put it up on the web.
Uh-huh.
But when we got there, everybody was feeling so bad. It was just like, all right, let's just get the picture, one group picture, and get the hell out of here. And so then that's what we did. We had to wait to get our picture taken by the sun because there were other summiters up there. And so we...
Wait a minute. Hold it. You say it was a crowd by the sun? That's the wildest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. That's how many people... They say something like 15,000 people a year attempt the mountain, and about half of them summit. So... You know, over 7,000 people a year are summiting this mountain.
Well, it'd be a, you know, nice place for a Starbucks.
Oh, yeah. I think so. And, you know, there's a big sign there that says, you know, Uhuru, the highest point on the African continent, 19,340 feet. And so we all stood there, the four of us, you know, got someone to take our picture.
Mm-hmm.
We were all looking pretty rough, you know. I hadn't shaved for a week. So we got our picture, and then we just immediately headed back down, and we passed two other members of our eight-member group still on their way up, and they seemed to be doing pretty good. They made it to the summit and got their picture and turned around, but we were probably about a half an hour ahead of them, so we were well on our way down by the time they turned around.
So, but you don't camp up there. You don't.
No.
You start back down to this.
Start back down immediately. The last two of our climbers, they made it to Gilman's Point, but the one girl was feeling the altitude pretty badly, so they turned around at that point and went and just headed straight down.
Were you starting to feel better on the way down?
Oh, yeah, immediately. As soon as you start heading down, you start feeling better. You know, once you start losing altitude and a little more oxygen in the air, you start to feel pretty good.
When you were camping, like when you camped in the desert, do you build a fire?
No fires, but you, you know, we do have meals, hot meals, because we have a porters and kitchen staff that come with us, and they only went as high as school hot, which is 15,000.
Yeah, which is the building that's there.
Right, and then they traverse around the mountain and meet us on the way down because we came down a different route than we went up, so they don't have to go any higher than that. But they, you know, they have you know, Coleman stoves and stuff to cook our meals, and so we had decent food the whole time, soup every night, and you know, usually fried potatoes, chicken, some kind
really?
Of chicken. Yeah, yeah. So actually, on December 31st, aside from New Year's, it was one of our climbers was having a birthday, and they actually baked a birthday cake for her.
Of course, you know, this thousands of people have done this, so yep. they know a lot about doing it.
And, oh, yeah.
And okay, you're in the middle of this desert. There's nothing around you but people, and nature calls. What do you do? Just kind of wander off the trail and hope for the best.
Yeah, pretty much. There was not much in the way of privacy in that area. In other areas on the mountain, you know, you could go behind a tree or a rock or something.
Let me just tippy-toe behind this tree and,
yeah, exactly.
You know, that kind of stuff. Well, you know, I was going to ask Eric that last week, and I forgot, but so I just ask you, just to, so you're just out there.
Yeah, you're just out there.
This, we act like this is not the first mountain you've climbed. You've done.
It's the first major summit I've done, but I was in Nepal actually with Eric in 2001 when he climbed Everest.
Uh-huh.
I went to Everest Base Camp with him, which was about 17,500 feet. So I do have some experience, you know, in high altitude trekking.
Why did you not go on then? You didn't have the experience to do that. They didn't ask you, or they?
Well, no. I mean, I did not have the kind of experience to try a mountain like Everest, and you know, and so yeah, I wasn't about to even attempt it. As a matter of fact, Eric had asked me several times to go to base camp, and I turned him down because I didn't think I, you know, had the kind of experience to even get to base camp. But I eventually caved in. And
you did decide to do that?
Yeah.
To go to the base camp, which is, like you said, it's 17,000 feet.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
That's no, to pardon the pun, picnic.
No, it wasn't. I when I got there, I just couldn't believe, you know, people were going to be living there for 2 months. There was a third blind guy on that expedition, Maurice Perret, who he stayed at base camp throughout the climb, throughout Eric's climb. So he was there for 6 weeks, and I did not envy him because, you know, base camp, Everest base camp is just...
Well, why did he want to do that?
Well, originally Eric had asked me to be his base camp manager. He basically, Eric wanted a blind person to be at base camp when he summited, which I thought was a cool idea too. And so I was going to do that. I was going to go and stay at base camp through the climb.
Yeah.
But it just, politics turned out that didn't work out because it was being funded by the National Federation of the Blind, and they wanted, you know, rightfully so, they wanted one of their people there. And I'm not a member of the NFB. So
yeah.
So they said, you know, no, you know, we're not going to pay for you to be there throughout the climb. So they put more reason.
And you actually have to work for a living.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
so where is it from? Where do we go from here? What are you going to do now? How by the way, you're 30.
I'm 37. Yeah. So next, I don't know. There's a possibility I may go to Russia this summer and climb Mount Elbrus, which is the technically the tallest peak in Europe, and it's about 18,500 feet, I think. And but it's a more technical climb than Kilimanjaro.
That's what I was going to ask. It's more of a technical mountain.
Yeah, because it's much further north, so it's glacial. So you know, you gotta have the crampons and ice axe and stay roped up with your climbing partner.
Oh, so it's a real. I mean, not that this wasn't a real mountain,
well,
but it's
right.
A technical mountain.
It's definitely a more technical mountain.
Yeah. So you're thinking about doing that?
I'm thinking about doing that, but there's no guarantee just yet. I'll find out in a couple of weeks.
Looking for sponsor? Looking for?
But not really. It's what happened was friends of mine who are doing it. They made the plan to go, and they wanted a commitment by December 20th. You know, and I said
you couldn't do that.
I can't commit until I come back from Africa. So right now I have to see if I can still get onto the team or if they've got.
Yeah,
all their spots.
They're interested in having
up.
It.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you, just complete change of subject,
sure.
About this. Have they sent you the message about the little speech engine that Carnegie Mellon has built?
I saw part of it. I hadn't read the whole thing yet,
yeah.
But I know the guys, you know, I've seen the guys, some of the work that these guys have done before.
Uh-huh.
And it looks, you know, I've been happy with the voices that they've put out before, and I can only assume that this stuff is just, you know, is just as good.
Will you get some stuff on that in 2 or 3 weeks, or when you get time, when you find out, come back, and because we'd all be really interested in that.
Oh,
that,
you bet.
That's going to do us. Well, Daniel, certainly you're not letting blindness stand in your way, are you?
Trying not.
It's a bad thing, but it's a hell of an inconvenience, isn't it?
It is.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you, and onward and upward, as I say.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
Love
to a warmer
is
place,
Blind,
but, you know,
the audio magazine,
you know,
for singles.
To find. Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll-free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com. Blind Sites. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
For those of you who are like me and who are big fans of National Public Radio, you might remember that a couple years ago they presented a series called Lost and Found Sounds. And this series consisted of them getting people to send in old recordings that they had so they could be played on the air and to find out the stories behind them. And there were quite a few kind of novelty and interesting things, from a recording of somebody who'd been an eyewitness at Lincoln's Gettysburg Address to someone who had recorded a bunch of old electric fans that they had in their home, and just everything in between. Well, if you want to hear some of these programs, they're all up on a website off of the NPR homepage. The website is http://www.npr.org/programs, that's /LNFSOUND/STORIES/. Again, I'll give that to you one more time without any interruption. http://www.npr.org/programs/LNFSOUND/STORIES/. I give the site a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And for Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
The members of our list, became acquainted with Max Robinson when he joined the list, and we have had him once before on our show called Blind Like Me, which is this little show here, and found out that Max has a degree in physics. Max, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm just fine.
Good, and we're glad to have you again. Max went to Houston with us.
Yeah, I was in Houston. That was a lot of fun.
It was the most fun I've had in a long time.
Yeah.
Susie and the Cummings and the Farrens are all on me to do it again next year, and I think I've got a heck of a good deal for us next year, but I'll save it till Emily. Emily's working out a deal where we might have some a little lodge to stay at, but it's not confirmed. But I'll get back to you. Let me start. Oh, I forgot to start my watch. Let's see. Get my Stopwatch. There we go.
Okay.
Oh, you have you have alluded to several things. Before we get into your website, tell us about this thing that you're doing with the newspapers in your home state of Kentucky.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me correct one thing. My degree is in electrical engineering, not in physics.
Not in physics.
Yeah, I taught physics, but my degree was in electrical engineering.
But you did teach physics.
Yeah, I did teach.
We're talking at a college level.
At a regular university, Western Kentucky University.
For a number of years.
Yes, 33 years.
And I forget, you have, I know you have some sight, because I've been around you some, but it's not not close to car driving.
No, it's 20 over 800.
Yeah, you could see enough to keep Susie and the rest of us blind people from running into stuff, but that's it.
Yeah. Well, I didn't keep you from running into Boop's Coffee, though.
Boy, you didn't. You didn't. You were there that morning.
I think I just come in when that happened.
We had run across you at breakfast. You were down. Everybody had gone, and pretty much, and you were there. Tom and I were having breakfast, and we found you, and Boop came up, and we got coffee, and I went upstairs and just knocked it right over. I don't think I'm ever going to be.
I'm never going to live it down.
No, I'm going to have to send that girl something, a coffee grinder. Did you see somebody suggested that I send her some beans in a coffee grinder? I guess I'm going to have to do something to get forgiveness from
her. I guess so. Well, to get around to answering your question,
all right.
The ACB up in Louisville, KCB, Kentucky Council of the Blind, is running a what they call a talking newspaper.
Uh-huh.
And somebody who you have to sign up for it, but once you sign up, you can call in, and using a tone dial telephone, you can access several different publications, and it's all for free. It's there's no charge for it. National newspapers as well as the local ones, and so they have an expert. A computer guy named Will Smith, who has been doing it all by hand. He goes to the newspaper site and copies and pastes. You know, he'll copy the articles, paste them into a word processor, and then save them as text files.
Every day.
Every day. Does that every day? He gets up at 4 in the morning to do the papers, the morning papers. And somebody somewhere wrote a program called Web Hunter, but it had some shortcomings. It worked with the newspapers that it worked with, but it wouldn't work with some of ours in Kentucky. So I said, well, I'm going to have to build a better mousetrap, I guess. So I wrote this program that I call News Retriever. I wrote it in Visual Basic. Now, there's something for you, isn't it? A blind man working in Visual Basic.
Visual Basic is a language?
It's a language,
Okay, a blind guy working in Visual Basic.
It's kind of related to the old Basic. You remember the old Basic?
Sure, I remember hearing about it. I don't know much about it, but I know what you're talking about.
But it's descended from that, actually.
Now, can you see well enough to... You using Zoomtek or something like that to in larger screen?
No, I have magnifying glasses that I've had since I was about 15 or 16 years old.
Okay.
That work really well.
All right.
Some of the best low vision things I've ever seen. And I'm always amazed that other people don't have something equivalent to that. I think maybe somehow the idea got lost.
Well, the first person that comes to my mind is Don Shaw.
Yeah, does he have something like that?
No, he does not. But I think that would help him because
it's a magnifying glass, but in a glasses frame. So you put them on your head, and their hands are free. You don't have to hold a magnifying glass in hand.
You'd think that would be perfect.
It is. Well, it's not perfect. It's not 20/20 vision.
Yeah.
But it's much better than I've seen people working with a computer that hold a magnifying glass.
And so you wrote a program that will do what now?
Okay, well, it goes out to the website and finds the links to the articles. And I have to fill in boxes that tell it where to look, you know. And then finds links to articles and then downloads the articles to my computer. And then scans through and cleans out all the code, because when you get a website, it's not just pure text. It's got a lot of stuff called HTML code.
Sure.
and this downloads the raw HTML code, so I have to clean all that out with a program, and then and it converts it into a text file, and then I count the words in the article and do a computation of how long about how long it'll take to read it approximately, and put that in as text, and then put in a signal that signals the talking newspaper software to pause and generate a tone at the end of the article. And so it does all that automatically, and so then all I have to do is just upload this big text file to the talking newspaper site, and somebody else takes it from there and takes it. I think it's Carla, not the Carla on our list.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Her name is Carla Rusheville. I think she runs the newspaper site, and she takes the article and puts it in the right place and puts it in the index and so forth, so it'll so people can access it.
Now, what is the purpose of the tone at the end of the article? Is for what?
That's to tell people that's the end of the article, and
okay.
Also it signals the software to say, well, actually, there's a you embed a thing a piece of code for the talking newspaper that tells it that's the end of the article. This tell the listener that, yes, this is definitely
okay.
The end of the article.
So this is a physical, an audible tone like you'd hear on your talking book tape.
Yeah, uh-huh. And it's
okay.
Just a little piece of code that generates the tone.
Sure. Now, are you hand doing this every day?
No, I don't have to hand do it. Now, I wrote the program, and I just have to load I call it the retriever, load the control part. And, you know, I have the part of the program that's the fixed program, and then the thing that you load that controls it that sends it to different newspapers.
Okay.
So I load the one for the Bowling Green paper news section, run it, and it takes about, depending on how many articles, anywhere from a minute to 2 or 3 minutes to run. And then that generates the file and then the output file, and then I load the part for the sports, for the Bowling Green paper sports, and the part for the Bowling Green paper obituaries, and you know, so on and so on.
You're confusing me because you're saying I do this. Do you mean
yeah.
The program goes and does it without you knowing?
Yeah, I have to load the part to the program and click on the button that says go. And actually, I have to
okay.
Click on 5 buttons in sequence to get everything to do what it's supposed to do.
So
but it doesn't take very long.
You're having to do this every day.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And so anybody in Kentucky can read papers that you're not going to find on the big, you know about the big NFB site.
Oh, yeah.
That you...
They run a big NFBK. NFB of Kentucky runs a big site in Louisville, but we're going after the small papers that they don't mess with.
That the little ones that they don't have time to fool with.
Yeah, there's a little weekly called the Oldham Era, the Oldham County paper in Kentucky that I do every week that they don't mess with, you know.
No, that would be beneath them. That would be much too small for them.
I guess so,
but
yeah.
there would be some blind people, especially older blind people, there that would read that.
One person told me at the state convention that, I sure like having the Oldham County paper on there. He's from the county, and he said, I sure like having that on there. So, it's nice. And they hadn't had been able to capture the obituaries. Will Smith is working in DOS, and the way the obituary page was set up, he couldn't capture it with his... for some reason, and so I wrote a little conditional into my program that the test for obituaries and finds them. I won't go into all the details, but it mm-hmm. gets them, captures them, and so I upload that one every day. The Louisville paper obituaries, which almost there are anywhere from 80 to 100 listings every day.
Now, this person that was doing some of this, and I guess is still involved, is
yeah.
a totally blind
yeah, he
person.
Yeah, he's
so,
totally blind, and he can do the entire Louisville paper in about 15 minutes.
But But he couldn't get Jaws to do certain. Jaws just cursor just won't go certain places.
Right, and that's why he couldn't capture the obituary.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because it just won't. For some reason, it just won't go certain places.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You can sometimes route Jaws to PC and get, but that's primitive to me. Anyway, Jaws cursor ought to go everywhere.
Well, I agree. It ought to.
And I had no idea that you were a programmer. When did you get into this?
Oh, way back. When we got our first computer that you could actually get to and actually touch the computer in, I think it was 69 or 70. It was an old DEC 8. And we had teletype machines to program it. And so you could go into the room, and the computer was right there, and there were about 5 teletype machines, and you could sit down and program in a language called Focal, which was kind of a primitive basic. Somebody called it a retarded basic in retrospect. But that was the first small computer, and this was the precursor that said, well, maybe an individual can own a computer someday. And, you'd ask computer experts then, they'd say, nah, that'll never happen.
Did it in a big, absolute way. I don't know how, they're the greatest tool blind people have ever been given is the computer. Because that didn't nearly level the playing field, but it fixed it now where I can do something besides make you a tape or call you on the phone.
Yeah.
We can email back and forth. Do all the time. If you're not on our Blind Like Me list, you should be. It's a wonderful little list. So you're taking care of this every day for people in Kentucky. If someone is listening that doesn't know anything about this, how do they get involved with the ability to read the newspapers?
Well, that's a good question. It's not toll free unless you're. And it's not toll-free outside of Louisville. They're working on getting a toll-free line for this.
Getting a grant of some kind to do that.
Yeah, they're trying to get a grant. But right now it's only free in Louisville.
Okay.
Otherwise you'd have to pay long distance. So if you're in Louisville and you don't know about this, get in touch with anybody in the ACB. Carla Rusheville is the person who really runs it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know her... get in touch with somebody at the KSB, Kentucky School for the Blind. They all know Carla at the KSB.
There's probably a listing for Kentucky Council of the Blind, I bet, in the phone book in Louisville, wouldn't there be?
What do you think? I don't know if they actually have a listing or not.
But Carla Rusheable will be happy to know that we've talked to everybody about her. I think she does some editing for the ACB magazine.
Yeah, she does.
For one of the magazines.
Yeah, the Braille Forum.
Anyway, this is available free if you live in Louisville. And
right.
So get a hold of somebody will know, some blind organization will know how to tell you to get on this if you're a blind person and not aware.
Right.
And maybe very soon they'll have a toll-free all over the state type of line. All right, let's switch horses in the middle of a stream and talk about your. They understand that there has been a lot of updating and redoing and reprogramming on your website.
Okay, well, before we do that, we got to get me out of the doghouse.
Okay, yeah, boy, we do.
I'm in Sue's doghouse because I didn't mention her. Sue's my wife, and we've been married now. It'll be 33 years. We've been married since 71.
And I called yesterday morning, and she answered the phone, and I said, I want to, I want to apologize for Max doing an entire hour without mentioning, and she said, well, I am pretty much a part of his life. So hi to Sue Robinson,
we met in an astronomy class. She was.
Oh, really?
My minor was in astronomy. But when I got my master's in electrical engineering, and so they brought me up here to teach, and they said this was in 70, right, end of 69, start of 70, and the department head said, well, with this moon program and all, astronomy is very popular. We need help teaching it. So since you have a minor in astronomy, you can teach astronomy. Well, I didn't know a whole lot about solar system astronomy, which is what the course was about. Because I'd taken radio astronomy. That's what electrical engineering and astronomy add up to is radio astronomy. So I picked out a class that was a night class, and it was called Astronomy for Teachers, seemed appropriate, so I sat in on it and got permission from the teacher to sit in, the professor to sit in on it. And she was in there taking it for credit because she was getting her master's in education. And we were both painfully shy at that time. I don't know how we ever got started talking to each other, but somehow we did. And, one thing led to another, and...
Here we are 35 years later.
Yeah, here we are, yeah, down the road. And
well, good.
There.
All right, and it seems like a very bright, intelligent, happy woman.
Yes, she
a lady.
Is. Uh-huh.
Anyway, hi, Sue, and we're glad to have you as a guest on Plot Like Me. We didn't forget you this time. All right, now, okay. We'll go to Max's. What do you call it now,
okay.
Max?
Well, the tube site is called Fun with Tubes.
Fun with Tubes.
I do have one called Max's Music Place where my music posted.
And you do look, before we move from that, you do have your music there.
Yeah.
Because Tom wants a copy of this song that you sang about mine is bigger and better than everyone else's.
Okay,
you know which one I'm talking about?
I think that is posted. I think that's on one of the... I'll have to tell him where it is. I have a monthly webcast show that's up there, and I have it posted for a year behind. And I think it's posted. I have to tell him what month it's in so he can find it.
You have a monthly webcast show. What do you do?
I do about half an hour of all my own music, so I don't have to worry about copyrights or anything.
Yeah.
And chit chat between songs, and it's like I'm doing a little radio show. You know, it's about half an hour long each time.
And so you do this once a month and put it up there for anyone to go listen to.
That's right.
Well, one of these days, not tomorrow, but one of these days, I'm going to run one of those on Blind Like Me, just for fun.
Well, okay.
Why not? Well, you know?
Why not?
Why, absolutely. Why not? And that is at Max's old-time...
Max'sMusicPlace.com.
Max's Music Place.
And that's all run together. MaxsMusicPlace.
Dot?
Lowercase.
That's all .com, and you can go there and listen to some music written, recorded, and performed by Max Robinson.
That's
what a deal.
Right.
We'll do it, everybody. All right. Good.
And
Max's Music Place.
It's got links, and I've used alts in the links, so they announce right with JAWS. And So it's about as blind-friendly as I can make it.
Well, good. That's good. That's what we want. Now, but your other site is Fun with Tubes.
The other site is Fun with Tubes. When I was coming through in electrical engineering, I entered in 1960. So I got into the upper division in, it would have been 62, and my first courses still were all about tubes.
Sure.
So, I really learned tubes. I haven't just picked it up lately. I started out, I cut my teeth on them. So, almost literally.
Almost literally, really.
Almost,
yeah.
Because I was real little, I would love to take radios apart. If we had an old junk radio sitting out back of the shop, and I took it apart and broke one of the tubes to see what was inside of it.
You know? Really?
So, and I have, there are a lot of schematic diagrams, and they're all verbally described. Right below the schematic, there's a link. It says, for a verbal description, click here. And you set your cursor on it and hit enter, and it'll jump to that page.
I mean,
even if you're totally blind, you can handle this.
Now, these are for things for people to build or
they can build, or if they're just curious about it curious how the circuit works, and they can take it as far as they want to, really.
Uh-huh.
It all started really when somebody asked me, tell me what goes into an audio amplifier, a hi-fi amplifier.
Okay.
And so I've set up a whole series of pages that go through, starting from the phono input, the volume control, the tone control. You know, it's on a fairly fundamental level.
Uh-huh.
Takes you all the way through to the output stage, and I just. In the matter of fact, just yesterday, I uploaded some new information in the audio output area about the Williamson amplifiers. That was something I had omitted.
Now, you were doing this with tubes or transistors?
A tube.
You're doing this, as a tube?
All tube.
All tube amplifier. From you did it from the, not from the 110 side, but from the phono side.
Yeah, start from the phono and work through. Well, I did have a section. I do have a section on the power supply.
Power supply, okay. Okay.
It's complete. Somebody could, work through it and take a piece from here and a piece from there and build a complete amplifier. Based on what's on that site,
if you want to do more than just plug things together, and you're curious about how an amplifier works or what its components are, what its insides are about, this would be a good place to learn that.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Right, do you?
And I also have a section on the All American 5 radio, which was, a very popular radio.
Little five-tube super heterodyne radio.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That everybody built in radio school.
Everybody, yeah. And every company from Admiral to Zenith made.
Sure. Sure. A lot of them were direct dial tuning. You're actually moving the variable condenser.
Those were a little hard to tune in.
Oh, they were terribly hard to tune in sometimes. And then,
they put a really big knob on it.
Some of them had dial cords.
Yeah.
And then some of them had kind of a slip deal where you could turn the variable condenser or you could turn this other knob. It was in the middle, shaft in the middle, that would turn it slower.
That was a ball bearing planetary vernier is what that's called. Got little ball bearings inside there that turn, when you turn it, turn the opposite direction and give you a reduction gear.
They turn the variable condenser slower.
Yeah.
And those were easier to tune in.
I
had some of those.
But they wear out. On the old radios, they're all worn out. They won't turn anymore. The balls have worn down.
Yeah, and then there's those dial cords. My father was famous for replacing dial cords. Boy, he could loop. He could do that. He was good at that because his son Phil went through a radio every two or three months.
Well, I have sitting on my bench right now a Citation tuner, a Citation FM tuner. I don't know if you remember those.
I do.
I'm fixing for somebody else, and it had the dial cord in it is 6 feet long.
Good heavens!
There are two separate variable capacitors in it that you drive. There's one for the RF tuning and one for the oscillator tuning.
And you've got to have them exactly synced.
You've got to have them synced, yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
That is some dial cord.
No, maybe I haven't seen one of these. I bet it is.
And it was, it came to me broken, and I had to restring it. Luckily, the dial cord hadn't been totally pulled out, so I had some pretty good clue as to how it went. But
yeah,
it was still a job.
Around a lot of pulleys, and this is tube type, and so you... Now, just one more question. Do you have links to order tubes from your site?
Oh, yeah.
Do you
now? No, not on my site.
Not on your site.
I have links to places that have them. That's what you asked, wasn't it? Links.
Yeah, links to...
I have links to several different places. Antique Electronics Supply is probably my favorite. There's another one called Triode Electronics, and there are a few. I have a separate page for links. Just go there, and you'll find all these things.
Yeah, because tubes are still available. You may think they're not, but
there's still factories making tubes.
Sure, I've got a couple microphones that are old Altex that have a tube in them. They're my favorite mic. I love them. I've had them 40 years and wouldn't take for them. Well, sir, we're out of time. Give us your two websites again. It's Max's Music Place.
Okay, MaxsMusicPlace.com, and that's just all run together with no apostrophe in the Max's.
All right.
And all lowercase. And the other one is funwithtubes.net. It's not .com, it's .net. Although I actually did register the .com domain name and link it to it in case somebody forgets.
But you're using .net.
But I prefer to use .net because it's a non-commercial site. I want to keep it strictly non-commercial. I'm not selling anything.
Uh-huh.
And I say that right up front.
Funwithtubes.net.
.net.
All run together.
Right.
Max, I appreciate it, and tell Sue hi.
Well, thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
Bye.
Certainly a couple of interesting fellas. If you'd like to be a guest on Blind Like Me, please email me, phil@philpar.com. phil@philpar.net. phil@philpar.net. We'd love to have you as a guest. See you next week for more Blind Like Me. Bye-bye.